Dr. David Barb is president of the American Medical Association. He took the oath of office in June. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
You're a practicing family doctor with Mercy Clinic Family Medicine in Mountain Grove, Missouri. Would you start by sharing more about your medical background, notably your experience here in the Ozarks?
Sure. I have my clinical practice in Mountain Grove, mostly because that's my hometown. I grew up in Mountain Grove. My parents moved there actually when I was three. And I went to school there, graduated from high school there, and then went to the University of Missouri for my undergraduate and medical schooling. The only blot on my otherwise sterling career is that I had to escape to Kansas for my family medicine training. So I've tried to live that down ever since, but otherwise it's that's my educational trajectory. Came back to Mountain Grove immediately after my training and opened my practice there in 1983 and have been practicing in Mountain Grove ever since.
The American Medical Association is the largest association of physicians in the United States, representing just under 250,000 doctors. Given the size and reach of this organization, what's it been like to lead it?
This is a really exciting time to be in the leadership of a physician organization like the AMA. With so much going on in health system reform, and quite honestly, so much going on in other areas as well. The opioid epidemic, AMA is front and center in that, addressing the burden of chronic disease in this country, particularly things like uncontrolled high blood pressure and diabetes. So the AMA is involved in all of those things. We're also involved in improving medical education and ongoing professional development for physicians. So it is a fantastic time to be involved, and I'm very excited, quite honestly, to bring a Midwest perspective and a primary care perspective to the AMA.
Yeah, I wanted to get your take on how you would describe the state of healthcare in rural America now.
Healthcare in rural America is really challenged right now. In my role with Mercy, I oversee about 75 clinics, about 200 physicians and advanced practitioners, as well as five of our small hospitals for Mercy. I'm embarrassed to tell you how many openings we have for physicians in our rural practices in Missouri, southern Missouri. It is really challenging, and without physicians in the lead, it's a little hard to deliver high-quality care. You can have a great facility, you can have excellent nurse practitioners, for example, but without a critical mass of physicians, it's really tough. These are challenging times for rural health care for a number of different reasons. There's downward pressure on reimbursement to physicians and hospitals right now. Missouri did not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and that has made it more difficult because some of the other subsidies that were available to hospitals prior to the Affordable Care Act were eliminated with the idea that everyone would have coverage or access to coverage through Medicaid expansion or the exchanges. Well, when Missouri didn't expand Medicaid, that and the subsidies, the federal subsidies were going away, that really put a lot of the small hospitals in a bad shape.
And actually, there have been some closings here in the state. Do you have a number of how many have been impacted?
Scott, I'm sorry, I can't give you an exact number on that, but I can tell you that Missouri has lost over, probably by now, nearly $10 billion in additional funding flows. Both through not being able to expand Medicaid and through the loss of the so-called DSH payments that came to hospitals. That's a lot of money in a state like Missouri.
You had stated shortly after becoming president you could not support the Senate Republican health care plan. Attempts to pass that bill fail, followed by a failure of a partial repeal or a skinny repeal of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. What are the AMA's objections?
I think the easiest way to describe this is to look at how any bill will impact people. Will a bill result in people losing coverage? Will be fewer people covered under a new bill versus an old bill? Both the House and Senate bills were projected to have literally tens of millions fewer insured with the those bills as opposed to the Affordable Care Act. Second would be affordability. How easy is it for an individual who is going to get assistance to purchase insurance in the insurance exchanges? How easy is it for them to afford that? Under the proposed bills in both the House and the Senate, the subsidies for low-income individuals to purchase insurance in the exchanges was going to be cut very significantly. That makes it less affordable. When it's less affordable, people go without coverage. So does it make it more affordable? The answer to both to that question for both the House and the Senate bills is no, doesn't make it more affordable. Third big test for the AMA is, what does it do for the safety net programs like Medicaid? I would argue that the safety net programs are already somewhat underfunded. Medicaid is the poorest payer to both hospitals and doctors of any other payer. The House and the Senate bills both proposed substantial cuts to Medicaid funding compared to the current trajectory and current levels. It also proposed pretty significant changes in how those monies go from the federal to the state level. Probably more detail than we want to get into today, but right now, federal match of state funds. So if the state puts up $1 billion, then the federal government matches a certain amount of that. That varies somewhat from state to state, depending on some socioeconomic indicators for that state. But in any case, if Missouri puts up $1 billion, the feds put in a certain amount. If Missouri said, you know, we've got more people that need care under Medicaid, we're going to up that to $1.5 billion, then the feds continue to match that, you know, at a certain rate. The changes that were proposed in the House bill and to some extent in the Senate bill would cap that type of program and would not allow states, quite honestly, to have the flexibility to draw down more federal money if they chose to invest more in the health care of their residents on Medicaid. So we are against it because the total number of dollars going in would be substantially less, up to $800 billion over 10 years, and the mechanism for getting those funds to the states was not favorable.
Were there provisions in either the House and or the Senate bill that you could get behind?
So a couple of things are really important, and they're actually being talked about more seriously now. And one of those was stabilizing the insurance market. You may know here in Missouri, if we were having this conversation 6 months ago, I would have said to your listeners, there are 97 out of the 114 counties in Missouri that only have one offering in the insurance exchange. That's not much choice. And an individual might have to pick an insurance plan that didn't have their doctor or their preferred hospital on it because, you know, insurance company A was the only one offered in their county and they wanted to go to a hospital that was usually on insurance company B. Well, couldn't do that. Today when we talk, I can tell you that there are 24 counties in Missouri that now have no insurance offering in the exchange, and most of the other counties still have just one. Stabilizing the market, getting more insurance companies back in so that we have two, three, or four offerings in any given county is the way not only do we give patients choice, but that should also, through competition, drive down the rates to some extent. The way to do that is by restoring what are called cost-sharing subsidies to the insurance companies, and that helps reduce some of their risk so they're willing to get back into the market. One other area that we could talk about that we do like and is very needed, and that is extra money to fund opioid education and treatment programs. That is desperately needed. Those are underfunded, and there are simply not enough of them. So putting some more money towards addressing the opioid epidemic is very welcome.
The numbers you gave in terms of the insurance providers pulling out and a lot of the counties that they were pulling out of, rural parts of Missouri, could you tell us what you're hearing from your patients, the fact that they're having fewer options for health insurance?
So I don't want this to sound too parochial, but I'll give you this specific example. In Wright County, where I live, the only remaining plan there does not have Mercy Springfield as a provider. And so patients who've had a choice, who could pick a plan where they could see me in Mountain Grove and they could come to a Mercy specialist in Springfield, can still see me in Mountain Grove. But if they have a specialty need or they need to be in the hospital, then I have to refer them to a Cox Network provider. It could just as easily have gone the other way. So I'm not saying that as a Mercy versus Cox thing. I'm saying that as a patient, if I only have a choice that causes me to go to a network that was really not my first choice or was not the network that I had previously been seeing, the doctor-patient relationship is very, very important. And when the insurance markets come between the doctor and the patient and reduce the number of choices the patient has, that's not a good environment.
With the Senate health care bill now sidelined and a failure to repeal Obamacare, what do you see as the next step for Congress?
So I'm very optimistic, or maybe cautiously optimistic, that the failure of the bills in the Senate specifically will drive now a bipartisan conversation about how really to go forward with health care in this country. The Affordable Care Act did several very good things. It did expand the number of Americans that have insurance by 20 million people. It did establish a framework, the health insurance exchanges, that give us a mechanism to make insurance available to particularly low-income individuals. It did expand Medicaid. All of those were good things. The problems now that need to be fixed are things like the affordability. The deductibles are sometimes very high, and even in some of these plans, the premiums are still too high. We need to look at, again, shoring up the insurance networks. We need to look at spending the money that we do spend on healthcare wisely, to structure payments to physicians and hospitals in a way that incentivizes high-value care. And the same thing for patients. We need to look for ways to engage patients to be better consumers on their own behalf, not only for the economics of it, but for the quality health care and to know what's bringing value to their care and what is not, what's just a bright, shiny object that sounds good, that looks like it ought to be good, but really doesn't add anything to the quality of their care.
I'm hearing you would certainly welcome some changes to the Affordable Care Act.
Definitely need changes, and those are likely only to come in a proper way through a bipartisan discussion. For all the good that it did do, the Affordable Care Act was essentially passed exclusively by Democrats. In this last round, we were looking at changes that were going to occur, if they occurred, exclusively by Republicans. Neither of those probably gets us to the very best place in healthcare in this country.
What ways is the AMA currently trying to influence change or understanding of healthcare solutions?
So the AMA approaches our advocacy for change in numerous different ways. In many cases, we go direct to the public, and we have public-facing campaigns and informational campaigns that help educate the public. For instance, during this last round of discussions, we came out publicly against the proposals that were coming through the House and the Senate, and we encouraged our patients to make their own views known to legislators. We have physician-facing advocacy, but we also do direct advocacy with both members of Congress in the House and Senate, as well as with the White House or administration. And I have personally met with Seema Verma, who's the administrator of Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and I've told her how we think or the components, at least, that should be in improved health care reform. I've met with the chair of the Committees of Jurisdiction in the House. That's the House Ways and Means Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee. So I've met with those individuals directly and advocated for what we believe need the improvements that are needed. Of course, the AMA has a staff of lobbyists and policy analysts that routinely and regularly provide information to decision makers.
You mentioned opioid epidemic and trying to stem the issue. I wanted to discuss that a little bit more because there's been a lot of changes as of late here in Missouri with regards to prescription drug monitoring databases. Statewide, it was done by executive order from Governor Eric Greitens. And then you've seen local municipalities enacting their own PDMPs. Springfield was the site of the Opioid Epidemic Summit kickoff. Give me your perspective on some of the solutions and attempts to find solutions maybe through PDMPs or other avenues that you're witnessing here in the state.
So let's start by talking about PDMPs. And for your listeners, that stands for Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. And in its best form is a way that prescribers, physicians, can find out what prescriptions an individual patient has received. We are all probably familiar with the concept that a drug-seeking patient might go to Dr. A and then to Dr. B and to Dr. C and get narcotic prescriptions from all three of those. And those three physicians might have no idea, wouldn't have any idea in a normal circumstance that their patient had gone to three different doctors. They may go to three different pharmacies, so a single pharmacy might not see those three prescriptions. A prescription drug monitoring program, as I said, in an ideal setting, gives near real-time information to a prescriber as to what that patient has received potentially from other prescribers, and that helps considerably in safe prescribing, in identifying patients who may be getting into a habit of use of a narcotic that is not safe or healthy. That needs to be incorporated into the doctor's normal workflow. The more difficult it is for the doctor to access that information, the less likely he or she is to access it, and therefore it doesn't help. It does need to be real time, as I mentioned. There have been PDMPs in other states that only get updated once a quarter. Well, that doesn't help me know what my patient may have received a week ago or a month ago. So there are things that need to be incorporated in a good, useful database. The other thing that we don't think PDMPs should be used for is, generally speaking, for criminal or law enforcement purposes. These need to be for clinical care. And to use them, because there are other methods to find out how much I'm prescribing. If someone suspects I'm over-prescribing, there are ways to do that without a PDMP, already exist. We would actually like to avoid the PDMP being used as a law enforcement tool, mm-hmm. but much more interested in it being used as a clinical tool for safe patient prescribing.
Is this something you feel the state legislature should continue work on? After all, Governor Greitens' executive order was enacted because the failure of the state legislature, but does have some limitations to it.
It does, and it has some shortcomings as well. So, yes, I believe we can do better than an executive order. I think the legislature is responsible for this sort of thing and should continue to pursue it. There are excellent models in many other states around the country. They have been shown to reduce the amount of prescribing significantly, and when there are fewer narcotics being prescribed, there are fewer overdoses and fewer deaths from that. There are fewer admissions to rehab facilities. I mean, there are fewer people that are getting addicted to narcotics. So a well-run, functional PDMP is a very good thing for citizens of any state.
What are some of the things that you're looking forward to most as president of the AMA in the next few months and things that are kind of on the horizon?
Sure. So I'm going to take a little bit of a turn here and talk about some activities that the AMA is very deeply involved in, and that is improving the practice environment for physicians. If you read any of the medical literature nowadays, you hear about the burnout rate of physicians. It is higher now than it has ever been, and it is continuing to rise. There's some very good academic studies that have been done that show from 2011 to 2014, there was a significant rise in burnout rate across every specialty. There's a new study that we expect to be out just almost any time now that I believe will show continued rise from 2014 until now. That causes physicians to not be as fully engaged in their practice as they should be. It causes them, quite honestly, to just not give as good a care when they're burning out and dealing with their own problems. It causes them to retire early. And it is, in this era of physician shortages already, and when we need physicians to be at the top of their game and given the very best care to as many patients as practical, we can't afford as a society to not have doctors working at the top of their game. And they don't and they won't if they're feeling burnt out. So the AMA is working really hard to address those things that are producing that effect in physicians, much of which is the burden of what we believe is unnecessary paperwork. It's the burden of the an electronic health record that doesn't work for the physician or the patient in many cases. It is the burden of pre-authorization paperwork from insurance companies. AMA is working on all of those things, and we believe that by reducing those stressors and improving the practice environment for physicians, that will benefit patient care directly. It will improve the quality and the quantity of care that physicians can give. That will be good for everybody.
Is there anything else you'd like to add for our audience?
The one other area that we're very interested in, I mean, if you think about the mission of the American Medical Association, which is to promote the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health, we've been concentrating on health system reform. We've talked a little bit about opioid crisis, which clearly is directly for the betterment of public health, as well as improving the practice environment for physicians. But the AMA has taken a very intense focus on looking at uncontrolled high blood pressure in this country. There are 80 million people in this country with high blood pressure. 30 million of those say, I have a regular source of medical care. I know who my doctor is, but yet their blood pressure is still not controlled. That's low-hanging fruit. And those people are at much higher risk for the complications of uncontrolled high blood pressure, such as premature heart attacks and strokes. Same thing is true with diabetes. There are 84 million people in this country with pre-diabetes. The shocking statistic, if that's not shocking enough, is that 90% of those people do not know they have pre-diabetes and that they are at risk for progressing on to diabetes and all of the sometimes fairly serious complications that we know can come with that, including heart attack and stroke, also things like amputations. Uncontrolled diabetes is a bad disease. So the AMA has put a lot of effort into raising awareness. I was in New York City literally just a week ago and did 16 nationwide TV, live TV and radio interviews promoting the partnership that the AMA has with the American Diabetic Association, with AARP, the CDC, to promote the awareness in prediabetes. And there's a website called doihaveprediabetes.org, where people can go, they can take a very simple 1-minute test to learn their risk factors for diabetes. And if they score above a certain number on that test, they're directed to consult with their physician to further assess their risk and to find out what they can do to reduce their risk. So that is a very, very important initiative that has been very well received. We've had literally hundreds of thousands, over 400,000 at last count, people that went to that website and took that test.
Dr. David Barb, President of the American Medical Association, thanks so much for coming by to speak with us.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate the opportunity.